Hello, everyone. Welcome back. So across the dunes of times, winds of change have often reshaped nations. Welcome back to The Looking Glass. I'm Kosi, your guide through the intricate maze of history and politics. Today, we step back into 1969, where a young Muammar Gaddafi forever changed Libya. This is episode 2 of a miniseries called The Winds of Change, the Libya Chronicles. So joining us to unravel the complexities of this area is Professor Vandewalle, a renowned expert from Dartmouth College with extensive knowledge in U.S.-Libya relations. Professor Vandewalle, it is an honor to have you here, and we're delighted to have the conversation with you today.
Oh, thank you, Kosi. Delighted to be part of this conversation.
No, awesome. So I want to, you know, before we kind of dive into it, how are you feeling today generally? You know, what's on your mind? How is the 2023 winding down for you?
It's been very good so far. And of course, I'm in New England, so a little bit cold out here, but certainly a beautiful day and been a beautiful end of the year so far.
No, likewise. Yeah, we're here in D.C., so it's just, I'm looking out, it's gray. It's gray skies. Haven't seen the sun in a while, but hopefully, you know, that'll change soon enough. But, you know, I thank you so much again for the time, Professor. I want to, you know, dive right into the conversation because I'm excited to have it. I'm excited to learn a lot from you. So the first thing I really want to kind of set the scene for our conversation is, you know, Gaddafi's ascension to power in 1969 through a coup marked a significant shift in Libya. So could you please explain, you know, the things that led up to this moment, first and foremost? And secondly, you know, could you explain how the use of Libya's oil wealth shaped the country's military strategies and capacities?
Sure. And, you know, there is a little bit of a convoluted history to Libya. Remember, Libya is the only country created directly by the United Nations in 1951. A country really with no history of having been amalgamated, being put together, artificially put together, really, after World War II. Out of that emerges a kingdom that lasts for about 18 months, that enjoys relatively little legitimacy, except in the eastern part of the country where it originated. But certainly the other parts, Tripolitania and Fezzan, had no real knowledge of even working with the family that eventually came to represent that monarchy. And so when Gaddafi comes to power in 1969, it is really because the military in Libya, which was still quite disorganized, as a matter of fact, there were kind of two competing armies in a sense. There was still a Zanussi army allied very directly to the eastern part of the country. And so quite unprofessionalized, but still the only group that has managed in Libya to create some kind of corporate identity. And it's, of course, Gaddafi, very young at the time, 27 years old, estimated, that takes over and immediately sets upon this kind of course for his country that stands quite in contrast to what the monarchy had done. The monarchy was considered pretty much pro-Western. But of course, the discovery of oil in 1959 had changed a lot of the kind of what I would call the political process in Libya, which had been very low-key, centered around the monarchy. And suddenly, you know, as the military that Gaddafi belonged to develops that corporate identity, start seeing what is happening to the income from that oil money, how that family, the Zanussi family, and the people around it are really very closely tied to the West. And of course, Gaddafi then, influenced particularly by the Gamal Abdel Nasser and the philosophy that Nasser espoused, really takes up on that and then starts to chart its own course in many ways. And what is really interesting is that, one of the first things that Gaddafi says when it comes to power, he calls on Gamal Abdel Nasser and he says, look, you know, we made this revolution for you. We want to put the resources of Libya at your disposal. But of course, you know, whatever Libya had in terms of resources didn't amount to much. They really didn't have a military and so on. That's really the beginning of Gaddafi's foray, so to speak, into inter-Arab politics, in which he, until the very end, you know, when he moves away from Arab politics completely, he really was more or less an outsider. Whatever resources he had eventually became not kind of what I would call institutionalized into a national army that could be used for any purpose. But increasingly, Gaddafi became focused on using the resources of the country for what, you know, you could call kind of irregular warfare, in a sense, starting to support a number of movements in different countries, based on the fact that, of course, he objects to Westernism, first of all, and supports a number of organizations that are anti-Western, or at least profess to act against the state. And, you know, if there's one kind of very basic issue that kind of underpins Gaddafi's ideology in those early years, it's really that statelessness that he espouses, you know, the fact that Libya really should become, again, what eventually he will call a Jamahiriya, and that is a country ruled directly by the people. And so he puts the resources of Libya at the disposal of organizations in, that he feels have more or less a similar philosophy and really basically are anti-Western.
No, thank you so much, Professor, because you kind of hit a couple important points that we're going to flesh out throughout the duration of this conversation. The first one I immediately want to follow up with is what you concluded with is this this notion of a Jamahiriya established by Gaddafi, and it promised mass rule. So could you elaborate a little bit more on the sentiments behind this political notion and how to influence Libya's internal politics?
Sure. Well, you know, again, to understand what I think went through Gaddafi's mind is you have to back up a little bit. And Libya, of course, had been subject to a very brutal colonial experience under the Italians starting in 1911. And the legacy of Libya's first encounter with a modern state, in this case Italy, had really been very disastrous. You know, half of the population in Cyrenaica, it's estimated, was eliminated or put into concentration camps, et cetera, et cetera. So for Gaddafi, the modern Western state is something that is really completely antithetical to the well-being of individuals. And so he comes up with this concept of the Jamahiriya, which is a neologism that he himself made up, coming from Jamahiri, on the masses in Arabic. And what it really is he wants, in a sense, to go back to a kind of a tribal past where people are chosen by the people around them to represent them. And he deliberately uses that word, ikhtiyar, choice in Arabic, to bring that concept across. And so he argues that the modern institutions of the modern state are really quite illegitimate. What really should happen is that people govern themselves. And so he creates this very elaborate mechanism of popular committees and so on, you know, to kind of represent this kind of new political experiment that he wants to have implemented in Libya. He then solidifies that a little bit in the Green Book, his ideological guidance to all of that. But that's really where the concept comes from. And in a sense, it's a very contradictory concept in Libya, because on the one hand, you know, he wants to do away with the tribes, which could, you know, potentially be a source of friction and a source of opposition to him. And on the other hand, he's saying, well, we have to go back, in a sense, to that notion of some of the concepts, the political concepts that the tribe represent. And in a sense, he never really solved that completely. He was forced, in a sense, after he had ranged out the tribes throughout the 1970s and 80s, to bring back the tribes into Libya's political life in the 1990s. So again, a kind of a very contradictory philosophy in terms of the participation of citizens and what the notion of a modern state really represents.
No, it's quite fascinating, especially when you kind of interrogate Gaddafi's political awareness, but also its contradictions. I want to take a step forward in the progression of our conversation and touch upon another bit you mentioned earlier as we kind of started our discussion. It's really this the importance of oil as a determinant of the policies of Gaddafi and of Libya. So could you, you know, expand on just that correlation between the discovery of oil in the country as well as how that influenced Gaddafi's internal economic policies?
Sure. Well, I mean, in terms of, first of all, you know, Libya profited very handsomely, of course, when the country became independent in 1951. The per capita income was roughly $25 per annum in in the country. By the time 1969 comes around, and you know, the country has had more or less a decade of oil exploration and oil sales, that income has shot up to roughly $2,200 to $2,500. So you can see, you know, what, or you can readily guess what the impact of that is on a society. You know, when oil money comes in so rapidly, and the other part of that, of course, is that there were no real institutional mechanisms to decide what to do with that oil money. And so the monarchy had distributed it according to the wishes of the king, basically. And what we saw happening was, of course, that happened in exactly the same way under Gaddafi, where, again, there were no institutional constraints. And in a sense, the spending policies of Libya and the development policies of Libya were those that Gaddafi himself enunciated and that he himself wanted to sponsor. So there was a very big impact internally. But externally, of course, it also, in a sense, made Gaddafi, and particularly after 1973, when the price of oil quadruples, it made him, in a sense, if you want to use that word, independent. In that it gave him an enormous amount of power. He could kind of ignore, for example, World Bank advice and all kinds of things that countries normally have to abide by. And it's really at that point, and in part, as he tries to mobilize both Libya and the Arab world, which remain rather cool to his ideas, you know, that he starts to use this money again in very irregular ways, supporting causes of groups that we've just talked about a minute ago, that in a sense, you know, want to emulate what he is doing, or at least stand up to the West, or to, in some cases, Israel, of course, with the support for the PLO. But in, so that really fuels the infusion of money into causes that then eventually spill over into the support of actual terrorist activities by the regime. So the impact of oil money in Libya was both internally and externally, you know, very, very important.
I know, certainly, and I appreciate the pivot in terms of both. We kind of touched a little bit on, as the conversation progressing, we're discussing the ideological inspirations, both how it impacted the internal politics and dynamics in Libya. But now, as you pointed out, there's this external element too. I want to harp back to, you know, Gaddafi successfully has a successful coup, and he looks to Nasser and says, you know, this is for you. And I really wanted to explore that a little bit further and talk about, you know, Gaddafi is, you know, he's famously known for his pan-Arab, pan-African unity as kind of anchors and pillars to his ideology. So how did these ideologies drive his domestic as well as his international agendas?
Yeah, well, I mean, domestically, of course, the calls for pan-Arabism and so on was simply a pressure from Gaddafi to put on Libyans to participate in whatever pan-Arab initiatives existed and so on. But, you know, in a sense, it's very interesting, because if you think of the, you know, what we call the philosophy of Gaddafi, although I think that is really stretching the word somewhat, you know, what you really see again is this notion of statelessness. And so he appeals to pan-Arabism, which is above the state, you know, and again, that notion of statelessness comes up. And in a sense, of course, that is antithetical to what people like Gamal Abdel Nasser and so on are trying to pursue, with this very strong sense of Egyptian nationalism in his case. And so it doesn't really jive very well, you know, the kind of philosophy that Gaddafi has, who wants to restore, you know, the grandness of Arab civilization, et cetera, et cetera. And on the other hand, of course, people like Gamal Abdel Nasser and the Baathists in Syria, et cetera, and that also have a very nationalist agenda, but, you know, is very different from the kind of agenda that Gaddafi wants to pursue. And so in a sense, of course, then once it becomes clear that Gaddafi is not really taken seriously by the Arabs, you know, Gamal Abdel Nasser, of course, dies in 1970. And so what we see then is kind of a growing antagonism between Gaddafi and most of the other Arab countries, particularly the Arab Gulf countries. And so out of what I see, more out of desperation, out of lack of options in a sense, he then turns toward Pan-Africanism, roughly in the 1990s or so. And here it's the same thing, of course. He wants to create kind of a pan-Arab nation. Again, this notion of statelessness emerges, percolates back up. And then it's really when we see this period of Gaddafi starting to act as if, Libya is part of Africa, of sub-Saharan Africa, or linked to sub-Saharan Africa, and no longer really part of the Arab world. And we see, the very strange waves of dressing and so on that, become to characteristic Gaddafi in his later years.
No, absolutely. And it is fascinating for listeners to be able to kind of see the evolution of his attire and in terms of his rhetoric. And pointing to his pivot from Pan-Arabism to Pan-Africanism, this is also reflected in the liberation movements he was actively supported in or supporting. I really want to ask you, how do I frame this properly? To what extent was his involvement in these liberation movements a consequence of his genuine ideologies and beliefs, or is it a consequence of convenience?
That's a terrific question. And I think the answer somewhere lies in between. Gaddafi increasingly became convinced of his own philosophy. This was somebody who lived in a sense in an echo chamber. No one could really, tell the emperor that he had no clothes. And whatever philosophy he had put together in that little, the three little volumes of the Green Book, in a sense, didn't really amount to much philosophically. So that was the beginning of it all. And then, it just kind of expanded from there to where initially, with this kind of what I would call an emptiness of philosophy, almost of philosophical content. And then he also was very interested in supporting. Here, I think, is a kind of an insight into Gaddafi. I think he realized that he could not have any real direct impact. He could support these terrorist organizations, he could support the IRA, he could send some money to South Africa and all these other so-called liberation movements. But in a sense, there was very little that he could do to really affect the course of events. And so what I see more to Gaddafi than anything else is, that he came to realize if he couldn't influence events directly, then he could do so indirectly by becoming a spoiler in the process. And that's what I think, started to see more and more, throughout, particularly as we get into the 1980s, and then that kind of tapers off as we get into the 1990s. So it was both. It was both a philosophical commitment, what I think was a very undefined and very vague philosophy. And on the other hand, also the ability to pick up on these kind of conflicts that existed, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, where he could be the spoiler. And because he became the spoiler, was often seen as a party that could possibly help in resolving this. Although, again, in the end, I think that was also a pipe dream that many of the local movements in sub-Saharan Africa had vis-a-vis Gaddafi.
That's fascinating. And I have a couple more questions for you. And I think this question I'm about to ask, it's right along the lines of what you just mentioned, is just, his involvement or progressing from Pan-Arabism to Pan-Africanism, his involvement in these various movements has positioned him as, quote unquote, a spoiler and a potential mediator. But, the undertone of across all of these kind of philosophical advancements for Gaddafi was this anti-imperialist and anti-Western stance. So what were the consequences of this stance, not only to Libya, but also other movements that he was, had varying levels of involvement within?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, vis-a-vis the West, we both realize, the West increasingly became very, very skeptical and then openly hostile to Gaddafi because of what was happening, resulting then in the 1986 bombing of Tripoli and Benghazi. So it was very clear, that the West wanted to take a stance at that point, and that his philosophy was really creating a kind of a barrier between, Libya itself and the rest of the world, or at least with the Western world. In terms of the internally within Africa, I don't think it was ever really taken very seriously. But again, you know, he was kind of in the role of this arbitrator, this spoiler, in a sense, that could make hope, I mean, at least in his mind, influence events to move one way or the other, even though, again, I would be very skeptical that that really happened in one case. I mean, you know, one very telling detail to me always is that the only case where Libya actually engaged directly with its army in a conflict, the invasion of Chad, you know, was a complete disaster. And I think that more than anything else proved to Gaddafi that there was nothing to be gained by actively engaging these kinds of interventions, that the real strength of Libya, the poor man's way out, in a sense, was these the support of these movements that opposed the West and colonialism. And of course, again, as you said at the beginning of this question, you know, the basic, the bottom line really here is anti-colonialism. And again, you know, this this history that Gaddafi carried with him, that Italian invasion and the legacy that that left in Libya, and, you know, spawned all kinds of research institutes, et cetera, and, you know, focused on that anti-colonial strife. So that became really kind of a mother load, the anti-Westernism and so on, really became a mother load for the philosophy, which he then linked again to statelessness, and why the Arab world and Libya, in a sense, was, at least in his mind, a better political solution than a modern Western state that came out of the Westphalia system in the West.
No, this has been fascinating. This has been a fascinating conversation, Professor. And I want to close here with this last question. You know, we've been discussing Gaddafi's contradictions, really what he's done in seemingly short period of time, both his impact regionally and around the world. And I'm just curious, from your perspectives, how do you define his legacy? Is it one of contradictions? Is it more than that? Is it anti-imperialism? Just curious as to your parting thoughts on the matter.
I think overall, I would argue that the impact of the overall legacy of Gaddafi was rather minimal. I mean, certainly there were lots of incidences, you know, where the West stood up to him, and lots of incidences where, you know, he was involved in all kinds of adventures that, looking back at, you know, didn't really benefit Libya very well. His legacy in Libya, of course, is very disputed. There was, of course, and there still exists a core of hardcore supporters of Gaddafi. But overall, I think Libyans were quite disenchanted with the regime, and particularly as the regime then devolved into handing over power, particularly economic power, to some of the family, you know, the children of Gaddafi. I think, in a sense, for the Arab world, I think, yeah, he was to some extent notable in that he, you know, really carried that fight against the West and sensitizing the Arab world to the plight, to its own plight, to colonialism, the legacy of colonialism and of Western domination of global financial and trade structures, for example, certainly, you know, was valuable at one point, particularly at the beginning of his rule. But I think all of this eventually, and that I think is the basic lesson of the Gaddafi period, is that all of this came to pale in comparison to the increasing negatives that he engendered, and the increasing bizarre behavior that we saw. And that was, to some extent, rehabilitated a little bit when he then signed up to become our representative, so to speak, in the fight against terrorism in the 1990s and so on. But again, overall, I would argue very much at best a kind of a neutral legacy within the Arab world, certainly within Libya. And as for the West, I think if the legacy of Gaddafi means anything, it's that, in a sense, it's important for the West to send clear signals very early on to rulers that behave in this kind of fashion, perhaps tone down some of our own rhetoric and rather deal with this quite concretely, because a lot of the rhetoric and a lot of the legitimacy, actually, that the Gaddafi government garnered inside Libya and to some extent inside the Arab world had more to do with the opposition of the West to his regime than to the actual policies of the regime itself. So I think there's lots of lessons to be learned there overall for Libya, for the Arab world, and for the Western world, or for the world in general, on, you know, what Gaddafi came to represent.
No, certainly, truly a lot of lessons. But, you know, Professor Vandewalle, your insights has provided us, you know, a much deeper understanding of this complex era of Libyan history. And we want to thank you so much for the time you take it to speak with us today.
My pleasure. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, Kosi, and hopefully enlightening your listeners a little bit about Gaddafi and Libya.
No, they'll certainly appreciate it. And so thank you to our listeners for embarking on this historic exploration with us. Join us next time on A Looking Glass as we continue to delve into compelling narratives of our world's history. I'm Kosi Obuli, and I'll catch you all next time. Peace.